Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Crutella and William Kelly for part one of their discussion on sexuality, sex, and spirituality. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization. A quick warning, this podcast contains sensitive material that may not be suitable for some listeners and listeners with children. Discretion is advised.
Thank you all for joining us, whether you're live or if you're just going to be listening to this later on. And thank you, Bill. Bill and I have known each other for decades, and we've had lots of interesting conversations over the years about sexuality, and I would frequently consult with him as a psychiatrist about sexual issues and some of my clients, and he would consult with me, so we've kind of gotten to know each other over the years. And more lately, we've been talking about sexuality being so important in people's experience of themselves as a whole human being, including what it means to them in their spiritual sense. Before we start talking about that, I just want to give you a chance, Bill, to introduce yourself to people, let them know a little bit about you and your background.
Okay. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I also have a designation called diplomat in sex therapy, which means that I was a certified sex therapist once, and I've been around so long they decided to give me another name. And I've been working in the field actually since the 70s, where I started out doing sex education in a children's agency and then moved on to doing sex therapy. So it's been a wonderful journey, and I look forward to the next few questions.
So Bill, you and I, before this, when we were getting ready, I had wondered, you know, that it's such a large area to talk about that we could divide it up into maybe sexual identity issues and sexual behavior. And you very quickly and astutely said, you weren't sure about that because you think of it in a more integrated, integrated way. Can you say something about that?
Let's start out back in the 1960s. And sociologists were talking about integration of African American, particularly males, coming out of an oppressed place. And there was a text in a lot of sociological classes called Black Rage. There may be some of you who remember that if you took sociology back then. And from that model, that integration model, there's a woman named Vivian Cass in Australia, and a psychiatrist. And she wrote about sexual identity integration, and she put it into six parts. And those six parts were really helpful for me in a personal way as a gay man coming out, but also as a clinician, looking at when a client came into the office, where they might be in their journey in terms of what I call sexual identity integration, and the stages they're in, because a lot of people, first of all, were not told that we're in a process of sexual identity integration. And for most of us, there's really no roadmap for that. So as a child, and this may resonate with a number of you, there was only one form of sexuality, and that was male-female sexuality under the cover of a marriage for the reasons of procreation. And that's what we were told. So how our bodies work, masturbation, all kinds of things were left out of that narrative. And so as I've gone through and going through my own process of identity integration, and I've been sitting with others going through theirs, I've had a window to that process. And when Henry asked me to talk about this today, I was thinking, how does that affect our sense of spirit, our spark, our soul, and our shadow? How does that interfere with that? And also, how does that enhance that? So that's what I would like to talk about today, but I'm also interested in talking with you today about some of that. So that's a quick synopsis, Henry.
Thank you. So you mentioned soul and spirit, and you know, a lot of us have been working on the concept of the emergence of the feminine, sounding almost trite now to say it that way. But as a culture, we've been so patriarchal. And for me, what resonates with what you said is patriarchy is all about control. And it tends to be male dominated. And that's kind of implied in the name, but women can be patriarchal too. So it's a system of control and enforcement. I think of it as narrow-minded thinking. And to me, the emergence of the feminine is integrating a much broader perspective. And that's what I'm hearing in what you're saying. And in the research that I've been doing about the feminine, the issue of sexuality comes up again and again and again. And that in the patriarchal kind of view has been very normative. It's one way,
yes,
just as you described it. But really, what I learned in working with you over the decades is sexuality is so broad in terms of who people see themselves as, how they express it. What I used to think of as a medical student as abnormal in psychiatry is absolutely normal. The range of sexuality and its expression is just really wide. And as that has become part of our culture, struggling to get in, I think our sense of soul is just expanding in terms of who we really are in a totality. And I think a lot of that is coming from what you're talking about.
So some of the things that also expand, I think, that whole concept is the internet. So before the internet, people were isolated. And I like to think, and what I say to my clients, I didn't make this up. I think a woman named Peggy Brick, who was a sex educator in New Jersey, did, which is our sexuality is as individual as our fingerprints. Yours is different from mine and everybody on this telecast today. Everybody's different. There are some places where we overlap, like a Venn diagram. And often we can, for folks who can find those places of commonality, we can share our sexuality and our experiences and our connection. But for there are a lot of people that there are no overlaps. And I think for those people who don't have those overlaps, and those are a lot of the people I still see today, who begin to find those overlaps, if there are, they're finding them on the internet. And through that internet, the research on the internet tells us, or tells me, that our sexuality is exactly what you said, very broad. There's a book, and I can't remember the title at the moment, but something about billion nasty bits or something or other. And it's about two men who were working for the National Security Agency. And they decided to not look at individuals, but look at, but do a mega study on where people were going in the late 90s and early turn of the century. Where were they searching? Well, it turns out that 90% of people were searching on the search engines like AOL at the time for sexual content. That's where they were going. And at that time, 100,000 new sexually explicit websites were going up every day. Right. Well, then when you read their book, where were they going on the websites? Well, they were going to areas that we would call in the vernacular fetishes. In the psychiatric world, we call paraphilias. I don't think mental health has been very kind to
Correct.
People and sexuality. But it began to, their book began to sort of reinforce what I was already thinking, which is, again, if I think about us as individual, as our fingerprints, people were trying to find their community. And that's been one of the real pluses about the internet. But from a patriarchal point of view, and I'm not suggesting that people should be looking at images of children being sexually harmed, I'm not saying that, but from a patriarchal point of view, that begins to erode the control. Because if I can meet someone in Ottawa who has similar interests than me, or in Vancouver or Seattle or wherever it is, I'm no longer isolated. Because part of the patriarchal model is also to say that if you're not on board with our brand of sexuality, then you're a pervert, you're a deviant. And those are the words also used in psychiatric literature.
Right.
And yet that's not really what the research tells us. So I think coming back to the issue of soul, I think that, as you said, as people begin to find communities where they can be and they can be themselves, they get much more integrated. They can begin to talk about it. They can begin to express themselves without shame in those places. And from my point of view, that simply is a place of emotional health.
So you mentioned that your qualifier, you're not suggesting that it's okay to go on an internet site and look at child porn.
Well, I don't think it's okay. You know, there, first of all, very few people who are sexually interested in children. We use the word pedophile every day. Pedophile is a person who's sexually interested in a prepubescent child. But like Jeffrey Epstein was labeled as a pedophile, he would actually be called an empaphile, which is he liked adolescent females, apparently. But actually, pedophiles are a very small group of people. So when we talk about their spirit and their soul, their connection to their God through their spirit, and their soul, which is their senses, their desires, their affections, their appetites, in different parts of the world, pedophiles are treated differently. If you came to a mental health professional and said, well, I'm sexually interested in children, they probably are going to call the police before you even sit down on their sofa. If you're in Germany and you say that, or other countries, then people begin to find a way to be supportive of that. Because the issue for all of us on this podcast is not that patriarchal control, it's how we manage our sexual thoughts and feelings. And that's something all of us have to do. So in Germany, if you're sexually interested in children, then mental health would help you manage that. We don't do that very well here. We actually try to extinguish that through drugs and aversive conditioning and a whole bunch of other things because we have a different system. One of the things that I also want to say is whatever your sexual interest, you didn't ask for it. You know, I mentioned the internet was people are finding communities in which to be in, but the internet is also doing something else. The internet is there to help people cope. Sex is coping, because if you're looking at sexual images that are turning you on, that and you're altering your emotional state. And there's probably no more powerful way to alter that. I mean, I guess you could run a 10K or something, but this is another way to change your emotional state. There are some downsides. So people are managing that. And the overwhelming majority of people who are looking at images of children being sexually harmed have no particular interest in children. That seems a little ironic, but they have no sexual interest, or particular sexual interest in. What they're doing is because the images get old, you're wearing them out. They're looking for stuff that's kinkier and kinkier. So when I was in the sex offender treatment field for a long period of time, we did something called penile plethysmograph, which is, you folks don't want to know. But anyway,
I always enjoy when you talk about that.
Okay. So, but it measures sexual interest. And one of the things in treatment was to differentiate, is this person sexually interested in children or not? And this person being male. And if so, what's the type of interest in all of that? Well, most of the guys who were arrested and convicted of possession of generally tons of images of children being sexually harmed had no sexual interest in children. They were using sex as coping. So we sometimes get all those things mixed up. And we're only learning it about now because the internet is really new. But we're just at the beginning of having the research about that. But the plus of the internet and pornography is that people can find themselves and then find communities, I believe, and then begin to emotionally connect, not with the images, but with other people in that community.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. In mystical paths, like the Sufi path that I follow, there's a whole section that, to me, more and more, I think, is misunderstood, and it's called training of the ego. And the reason I'm thinking of that is that in that section, the implication, if you look at it superficially, is you have to beat your big bad ego into submission, which is very patriarchal.
Yeah, I would agree.
Not to mention it doesn't work. Or to make it work, you mentioned in your introduction about the shadow, you stuff a lot of things into the shadow that are bound to come back. And if they don't bite you, they're going to bite your sons and daughters and the next generation. Mystics believe in vibration. You know, you're adding to this vibration. And you may be fooling yourself by not having it expressed openly because you've repressed it. But that vibration is there. And that's going to get transmitted and it'll get picked up. As I think of it, the training of the ego is actually, just to go along with what you were saying, it's learning how to manage it. Here are the tendencies that my ego has. Okay, what do I do with that? I was given that. I was born with that. For a mystic, that's a divine gift that I have.
Absolutely.
So I don't want to get rid of that. What do I want to do with it? If I'm expressive, if I'm passionate, if I'm, you know, so, you know, another term we talk about is the facing. Some people interpret that to mean you get rid of. No, it's managing. It's making it more refined. It's making it a part of you that makes you feel integrated and whole and doesn't hurt other people, but it also doesn't hurt yourself or confines you into something that you're not. That's really exciting to see how this dovetails, at least in my mind.
I was just looking at my watch, and I'm really curious about the folks looking in, what reactions and thoughts and feelings you're having about what Henry and I are talking about.
Well, I'm just trying to digest the whole thing about people who look at violent things about children aren't sexually interested in children.
Yeah.
So they're interested in violence?
Marianne, this is my understanding. Okay, so a guy named Pat Cairns back in the 70s took a model of the stages of alcoholism, called the stages of addiction, and he took that same model and he called something sexual addiction, which everybody's familiar with the term. It doesn't really exist, but he created this belief. But there are people that use sex as coping. There's a lot of people who get on the internet at whatever time and they start looking at sexually explicit material, videos, pictures, whatever. And they're lost in that world because they're physiologically, emotionally, they're in those pictures. And often what they're trying to do is find the image that turns them on the most. But they're pretty much lit up emotionally like a Christmas tree. And there's also an underlying piece here for people using sex as coping. I'm going to find the right image or video or whatever it is that really is going to resonate with me. that's going to be really help me out. It's going to be the epiphany of my sexual interest. And so it's when I first started seeing clients like this, I'm laughing because there was one guy who was brilliant, but he had downloaded 300,000 images to the state of New York computer system. Okay. That's a different process than finding your community. Now, in that process, they're going through tons and tons of images. And sometimes, and they're doing, often what's, they're doing something called edging. This gets a little sexually explicit. So if you remember Masters and Johnson, defined sexuality in different parts. One was sexual excitement. So you get turned on. And then orgasm, and then something called resolution. Resolution is when we return back to normal. So between sexual excitement and orgasm is a place that's called plateau. And what the term on the internet is now called edging, which is people stay sexually aroused, but they don't have ejaculation and orgasm. They're just under that place. And they stay there for hours. Hours, sometimes 24. One guy stayed there for like 36 hours, okay? Just turned on all the time. Well, in order to do that, you got to find new material. So that's why they're looking at images of children, because they're looking at new material. You know, they may be looking at bestiality or whatever, but they're looking for something new. And that's the more what happens with people who are looking at children being sexually harmed, kiddie porn. They don't really like that term. I think it trivializes it, but that's what they're doing. The people who are actually sexually interested in children, these are mostly men, although there are some women, that's a very, very, very small group of people. So I don't know if that helps answer that question.
Just to go into that a little bit more, from a psychiatric perspective, the issue that I was always confronted with is ego strength. It's one thing if you have a fantasy. The question that has been really hard for mental health to answer is, what's the likelihood of fantasy being expressed in action?
Well, that's also the Catholic Church, I think. If you have a thought, you're going to act on it. If that were true, we would all be doing this telecast from Attica, which is a state corrections facility. We have fantasies all the time.
You brought up the Catholic Church, not just the Catholic Church. So in the mystical path that I follow, we believe in vibration. And there's also the teaching of the way you think, you will manifest what you think. That's not been my experience all the time, especially around sexual fantasies, just like you're saying. So the question that it brings up, and that I think Marianne was getting at, how do you tell that something can be contained in fantasy and not be expressed in action? That's number one, from a secular point of view. From a more spiritual, mystical point of view, isn't that vibration it's in your fantasy, but it's a vibration. Can that somehow, if you want to take a stab at answering this, but can that be something that's transmitted as well, even though it's not expressed? Just like we were talking about earlier, you shove something down in the shadow. Well, it's going to come out one way or the other, if not in you and somebody else. Well, if you have a fantasy that you can control so it's not manifested in action, is that energy somehow still going to get transmitted as well? So those are the two questions that I think are coming up. How can you tell when a fantasy is going to be held in fantasy and not acted out so people are safe, if it has to do with violence and children, et cetera? And then a more mystical kind of question.
So the vibrations, appetites, affections. Mm-hmm. I work with a lot of males who are sexually interested in children or pubescent individuals. To my knowledge, they never acted on their sexual fantasies. Their energy, that affections, went into teaching, mm-hmm. or some form of being coaching, whatever it is. And they really, from my perspective, created better lives for children because their awareness of themselves, where I have these desires, part of their soul. But I also know that it's harmful to do that. So there was also, they're aware of the consequences, not only to themselves, but to the children. So a number of my clients, again, are individuals who have contributed to the lives of children and young people. And yet, to my knowledge, there's never been a whiff of any propriety. So if you're asking how you measure that, yeah, in the sex offender field, there are ways that they're called dynamic risk factors. So if somebody has a lack of consciousness in terms of their antisocial or what's called high psychopathy, that's going to predict that you're not going to hire that person for the babysitter, let me tell you. Everybody in the room has met somebody who is highly antisocial. I call it the hair on the back of my neck standard when I had hair. So you feel uncomfortable with somebody in the room. You know that they're working you. You feel more like you're sitting with a predator because that's exactly what you're doing, rather than a warm-blooded human being. That's about 1% of the population, by the way, but they commit 26% of the violent rapes in the country. In a forensic population, they're going to be 50%. So there are ways to predict for some people, but also as the, from my perspective, as patriarch erodes and matriarch emerges, some things like the Me Too movement has made us much, at least me, much more aware, and a lot of other people I know, much more aware that people are watching now. So the shadow side probably gets a little more ascendancy when there's no consequences. But we live in a world where we're thinking about our children and now my grandchildren more in their protection. Opportunity is reduced. Reducing opportunity in a patriarchal system, that's, well, guys just do that and there was no harm and he didn't mean it, he was drunk, whatever it happens to be. There's always an excuse for bad male behavior. Now, not so much. And the consequences are horrific if you cross those lines. So I think those societal has changed, and for some of the reasons that you cited.
When I think of it from a holistic, soulful perspective, what I'm taking from this is even those fantasies can be useful. Instead of, like you joked about the Catholic Church, instead of saying, oh, they're wrong, and that vibration is going to go out and be manifested or transmitted, it can actually be sublimated. Now, as a psychiatrist, that's a pretty advanced defense. It's not that easy to sublimate. I think we're seeing, not just in the sexual area, but in the political area right now, a real concern that when you open up the lid and you take the controls off, all of this stuff comes out and starts getting manifested. So I'm still unsettled about this. I think for me, we have to be more accepting of the range of what is normal, what is valuable, in fact, to explore and to accept about ourselves, including that what's on the inside may have to stay there and not be expressed in action. At the same time, however, I can't help looking around and seeing when you give permission, all of that stuff comes out in a really ugly way. What's happening now with Asian Americans, because they're Asian, all of a sudden they're being attacked because of the coronavirus? That's not a very mature attitude. So I don't know if we want to stay on this particular point, but I still think there's a concern about how do we accept what seems to be normal, the range of normality in terms of how we can feel and think and imagine, knowing that somehow individually and societally and maybe spiritually, there also needs to be an emphasis on, yes, you can think that, no, you can't express that. I don't know if it was very clear.
So I think I'm of a different mind. Sexually, I think people, part of sexual identity integration is, as long as it's safe, sane, and consensual, then to explore this, okay, you know, the other thing is our sexuality is evolving. And so for you and I and for everybody listening, our sexuality, we know a lot more than we did at 15. We've experienced a lot more than we did at 15. And we're much more competent. And we did that through testing and learning. So I think that for people who, there are groups of individuals that their sexual interests may not be my cup of tea or your cup of tea, but as long as it's safe, sane, and consensual, then I certainly would make room for that. What's happening politically in our country or the United States and in other places like India and other places, and there's a concept called anti-fragile. And anti-fragile essentially means that things got to get broken. Things have got to be accentuated before we do things about them. What I'm noticing in terms of the racist thing is that, first of all, I believe I'm a racist. Bob mentioned that at one of our groups, and that's the way I felt for many years also. I couldn't possibly not be a racist. I grew up in a racist family in an all-white community, went to all-white schools, went to all-white churches, and I was taught things that are not true. But in our current political climate, people are saying, oh my God, we got to get together and do stuff about racism, sexism, and homophobia, and transphobia, and xenophobia. We got to do that. It's always under the surface. And so the anti-fragile piece is that we as societies don't do something until it gets accentuated. So while I hate what's going on, I really dislike what's going on, I also know that it's mobilizing people to do something different, even though we're polarized. I would see that as long as it's safe, sane, and consensual, I think that those desires, those interests, people learn from that. And one of the things they learn often, at least the people I see, is that they'll go to something like the Rochester Kink Society, where you can play out your sexual fantasies and find that was a fantasy that just didn't work for me. It's great in my mind, but it's, you know, first of all, I don't really want to spend all this money on the wardrobe. And once I did, it really didn't work out well for me. So part of it in that learning process is that when we engage with others in a consensual way, it doesn't work out. Yeah. So it's always about learning, and we're all learning. I'm learning at 70, a lot of stuff I didn't know, even at 60. I can't wait till 90. So.
Yeah. Maybe the learning curve starts to turn back on itself.
No. I'm still heading for the zenith. No.
Kathleen, you want to go?
I'm thinking about this business that we call human nature, where we kind of put our faults and maybe the things that are not safe, that are not sane, and that are not consensual, but still exist in the human psyche. And the impulses that we have, that we, as Henry said, we sublimate or we deny or we're civilized. So we have the civilized part of ourselves, and then we have the not so civilized part of ourselves. How does that balance out? And is that the line between the frontal cortex that runs things and that animal nature that we have, but usually don't give any credibility to?
I got to go to a neuropsychologist on that one, but Kathleen, so I'm not sure that we're as ruled as we want to think we are. Like 90% of people cheat on their income tax if they could. We do that stuff. Well, I would never do that, but yeah, right. But
nobody here.
But I think we're ruled more by consequence and social in our social situation. So it would be different for me to itemize some deductions on my income tax. But if I stole your car, probably people would be unhappy with me. So I don't know that we're as civilized as we wish to be. So I think it's probably how we define it. And it was fine when I was a young man to come on to a woman that I was attracted to and be very, I mean, not touching her, but be very directive. It was fine. In fact, it was sort of the James Bond sort of thing to do. Well, it's not fine. And we didn't think about it. So part of it is also the norms that are changing as we begin to understand each other better. I don't know if that goes anywhere near responding to your question.
That's a very interesting response. I'm not sure that I had a response in mind. It was just what was coming up in my thinking. And like you mentioned, or Henry mentioned, the aggression toward Asian people, which has no factual or reasonable relation to the virus itself. And yet it seems to be a thing that some people do. So it's just, I'm questioning that line between rational behavior and irrational behavior, or maybe instinctual or animal behavior, however you want to put it. There's some line between what we think we should do that's right and what we do anyway, even though most people think it's wrong. And I'm not relating this only to sexuality, but that's certainly there. Like, I think you can probably agree that many of the transgressors who've been caught up in the awareness of Me Too knew that what they were doing was wrong, but they did it anyway because they could, or they felt they could get away with it.
Oh, yes, I agree. There was a wonderful book called The Other Victorians, and it's about 19th century in England that everybody was pretty stuck up sexually and repressed. That wasn't the case at all for men particularly. One of the lines from the book is, no subject provokes fixed responses as the topic of sexuality. And so many of you may have found this also, which is that when the topic of sexuality comes up, people give often fixed responses or feel intimidated about having a really down-to-earth conversation. And I think that's an early childhood experience for most people. For me, as a child, I tell the story about going to my brother's christening. He was 3 years younger than me. And I wanted to know, where did this baby come from? Because we're driving in my father's car. It was not my mother's car. She didn't drive at that point. Where did this baby come from? And she said, now raise your hand if you got the same line. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you when you're older. Since I turned 70 in July, I'm still waiting. Okay. And so I decided I'd help this poor person out. And being, I was 3 years old at the time and obviously precocious. I asked her if it came out of her mouth. No. Come out of your nose. No. Come out of your ears. No. I don't know the term I use for rectum and anus, but I use whatever that term I had. I asked her if she came out of her penis. I didn't know that she was different than me. It took me years of working with Henry to work that through. And finally, she turned to my father and said, John, make him stop. But I got a very important message, which is, this is not a topic we talk about openly and candidly. And the adults around us get really uncomfortable. Part of that journey, that sexual identity integration piece, is I think we're often hampered by those early messages. And we're also hampered, I think, at least my experience is, I could talk with my buddies about stuff, But I couldn't talk to my parents or adults or teachers, you know, teachers, those people that might have had some more information. And of course, this is before Oprah and Donahue and the internet. Sadly, when we look at the research, where are kids getting their information now? They're getting it from the internet. They're not getting it from their parents. If they get anything at all, it's where all the parts are, but not about how we really operate or feel or think or experience or evolve in our sexuality. And right. So many of us are left out on our own. Yeah.
I would dovetail from a more spiritual point of view. Spiritual practitioners do the same thing. So, you know, religions, like I grew up Catholic as you did.
I was Episcopalian. I got all the pomp without the guilt. Yeah.
Right. I had all the guilt. Well, I have pomp too, so.
Yeah, okay.
But even in spirituality without religion, I think it's, from my point of view, it's still the going thinking that there's a right way of being. There's a right way of looking. There's a right way of acting. And if only you knew what that was, the Catholics would say you would be able to get to heaven. And I used to go to confession and have to confess all my impure thoughts. And I'd walk out of the confessional. And then, you know, I was kind of compulsive. I would have to turn around and go right back in because they had an impure thought as soon as I walked out of the confession. And the best thing I ever did to manage it is I was taught that if you actually forgot to confess the sin, you were absolved anyways because you honestly forgot it. So before I went into confession, I would pray that I would forget this particular sin. And sometimes it was quite successful, but not always. But really, I think what I am coming to, as we've talked more and more, and you've been, I told you this, and I'm not just brown-nosing you, you've been a mentor to me and an influence in my spirituality as well as in mental health, is that we have to be a lot more accepting of who we are. And that, in spite of what I said earlier about my concern, maybe from my early upbringing about, well, if I have this impure thought, that means I'm going to act it out. And then, oh my goodness. And then if the only reason I don't act it out is because of consequences, like you say, then I'm really a bad person, because a good person wouldn't need consequences to keep this awful. I wouldn't have this, and I can go around and around, right? But the other side of the coin that I want to emphasize is, once we get off this shtick and just accept it's okay, right? And what's the trio you had? Safe, sane, and consensual?
Consensual, yeah.
Right. Safe, sane, and consensual. All of a sudden, there isn't as much pressure. There isn't as much pressure to act it out, because it's not in my shadow anymore. I mean, that doesn't mean I have to go tell everybody. It means it's not in my shadow. I can admit to myself, this is who I am. All of a sudden, I don't have the impulse to act it out, because I know I'm not going to act it out. It's just okay to be me. And if you're on a spiritual path that's not patriarchal, and that really believes it's okay to be whoever you are, because that's how you incarnated. And again, this isn't an excuse to act out. It's saying, look at the totality of who you are. Look at your images. Look at your dreams. Look at your fantasies. And let them teach you what you are. Don't train your ego not to have them. Train your ego to look at what gifts are in there.
Yeah.
That makes a huge difference, I think.
Absolutely.
Just listening to the discussion of the expression of the wild and suppressed, if I'm hearing correctly, if I may be interpreting it and using different words, I apologize. But it's interesting that if you look at the expression, dance is closely related to the expression of sexuality and culture. And if you look at the beginning of the 20th century into the 21st century and how dance has evolved from a very social engaging couple, a couple dance, like social dancing, waltzing, and, you know, very refined and civilized movement that you do with another person, and then starting with the wars, it begins to break down into a very isolationist kind of movement, and it affects all the, in ballet and in modern dance, it became more and more abstract, less and less narrative, until it's become very isolationist and very angry. And today we see expressions with hip hop dance and all these kinds of movements that are expressing just raw sexuality. And then what's weird is that when people go off stage, there's no difference, like there's a complete blip between their expression on stage and their who they are as individuals off stage. And the only reason I've kind of noticed this is because I'm in Middle Eastern North African dance, which is remnants and harkening back right to pre-monotheistic cultures where they had fertility dances and women were seen as embodiments of that blessing. And dancers who dance that are just highly sexualized. And of course, the way that the dance is performed today in commercial places, it's very, women are very objectified and it's all done, the costuming and everything, unless you see it done in its traditional form. But it's very interesting when you try to teach that in its traditional form and people are expected to be vulnerable and just be themselves while doing these very, not suggestive, but it's part of the dance. You reenact the mating dance between birds, or you do a mating dance with maybe a little human interaction, but it's incredible how when they realize that this is sexuality, how very shy and vulnerable they get. But when they start doing hip hop and they're totally detached from themselves, it's incredible the amount of energy that they put into these raw, very suggestive movements. And they don't seem to realize that what they're doing is the exact same. It's not the exact same thing. And the one has a lot of aggression in it and the other doesn't. You have to take responsibility and present the dance as part of who you are and acknowledge your audience and actually be in communication with them versus this, like, I guess the best example everyone is probably familiar with is, like, for example, during the Super Bowl, when Shakira and Jennifer Lopez did that dance, the pole dance, right in the middle, and that created a lot of controversy. Well, decades ago, that would never have been allowed, right? That kind of dance was not accepted socially, for one thing, and would be immediately identified as pornography. But today, it's just part of our culture. So I just thought I'd bring that up because it's an interesting support to what you're saying. And it's just hard to work with people. I mean, when I teach dance, I try to help them to, like, become comfortable with their bodies and that this is an extension of who they are, not something separate from their being, right? That this isn't something that you just leave when you walk off stage. It's actually who you are. It's sad to me to see all this anger. I mean, I don't do hip hop. I can't. It's very angry to me. It's a very angry dance form and it kind of hurts to do it emotionally for me. So I can't do it, but I understand why people do it.
Part of my life, it simply would not have been safe to be out as a gay man. But dance was one of the ways that I connected with myself. I remember the movie about Bob Fosse, All That Jazz, which I still love to see every once in a while, and just watching that mesmerized by how he could take choreograph things that were so expressive to me in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. But dance became more about, yeah, I think he did. I'm not so familiar with some of Fosse's work. I did see the movie though, it was great. But just the whole culture, you know, it starts to get away from the body and working with your center of gravity and becoming, Western culture has evolved a form that has become less, I don't know, less internalized and more abstract for better definition. They explore language on a different level and it's a very personal one to the choreographer and not as much a communal one, like one that can relate, I think, to audiences. The key is to find a way to do both, to have something unique and then bring it. But anyway, I just threw that out there. I mean, it's distressing to me. It's to see, like, I see 14-year-olds rolling around over each other on a stage and then, you know, their parents are fine with that, but oh no, you can't learn, like, traditional, you know, Middle Eastern dance that has none of that. or none of this Tootsie Roll, Jelly Roll, you know, I don't know, all those hip hop movements that are so aggressive with their sexuality and have it be okay. I mean, they don't relate to that. Like, there's no person in there when they're doing it. They leave who they are behind when they go and do that, and they don't integrate it into the, because they're not expressing themselves from a personal, it's not a personal concept. It's not a personal expression for them. It's just something that they're doing. I'm trying to, forgive me, I just don't have any other words for that.
What I'm hearing is that it's not integrated.
And that's, yeah, exactly.
What have we been talking about is that, yeah, you know, we find other ways to express it. So you could, you know, not that hip hop, not that hip hop is bad or anything like that.
Right.
When you put it into the shadow and you don't allow it, it's more likely to come out somewhere, and not necessarily in a better way, maybe, but it'll come out. We have to stop fooling ourselves. And I think, Bill, you and I talked about when we thought about doing this was what we're getting to, which is to be a whole human being. You can't be ignoring this stuff. And that's what I think is so valuable.
Since you've asked me, there was a lot of thought and a little obsession, I suppose, about how this was going to go and what I was going to say. So thanks for making it easy. And I enjoyed the hour.
I want to thank Bill as a friend and a colleague. The other part I want to highlight is one of the reasons I invited Bill in particular is I hope you can hear not only his personal commitment and how this has become integrated into his life, this is very personal for him, but also the depth of his training. This is somebody who has really looked into extensive research to validate a lot of what he's saying. And a lot of us, I think, are faced with things we learned as kids, even in psychiatry. You know, psychiatry changes depending on how the committee votes. And you hope the committee is voting based on research. In medical school and internship and residency, homosexuality was a perversion. And I'm trying to wrap my mind around, how could we have said that? And then how could I have believed that? I swallowed that. And it's like, and then the committee said, oh no, the research is, that's incorrect. And all of a sudden it was, oh, okay. But I look back at myself and say, don't I have a brain? What was I thinking? Or how could I believe that stuff that didn't, it just didn't make sense. And so I think it behooves us to really look personally and then do the work, do the research. Personal research, you know, those of us on a mystical path, listen to the inspiration that's coming through and then check it out, do the research. And what I think we're finding, what I loved about this talk today is the richness at really being a free, whole human being, safe, sane, consensual. That's real love, harmony, and beauty. It isn't a prescription that's supposed to fit everybody. We're all on our own unique path. So I find that really exciting and freeing. And thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you, everybody.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcast, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amberlight International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Critella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.